I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to these teachings, and your support really makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering Dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much. So, as many of you know, tonight is going to be the third talk in the series on the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's main instructions for our practice, which includes the four Satipatthanas, or the four foundations of mindfulness. And tonight we are on the third Satipatthana, which is mindfulness of mind, or mind states. And just to review, we started out with the first foundation of mindfulness, which is asking us to be mindful of the body, which is where we start and end, right? And, you know, we cannot experience life, let alone any mind states or anything at all, without this vehicle, our spiritual home. So we really want to get to know it. And in the Buddha's time, by the way, that was revolutionary. Everything was outside of the body. So this is a revolutionary topic in a way. And we are asked to get to know the body very intimately by waking up to it, by being aware of all its aspects, including the breath, okay, which we start with, all the body's postures. You might even notice how you're holding the body now. Are you aware of the body now even, right? Body as a whole, and then all of its 32, what are considered its 32 parts, right, which I mentioned earlier, includes everything, including snot and urine and all that good stuff. And its elemental nature, right? And also its impermanent nature. So this is a summary, but these are kind of the bullet points, how we're supposed to pay attention to the body. And then from there, we're asked to explore the second foundation of mindfulness, feelings, or vedana, by experiencing and getting to know all the various energies or tones or tastes, if you will, in both the mind and the body as we make contact with the world, which we do all the time. And as we pay closer and closer attention, we can start to sense and perceive this vedana at almost a micro level as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And as we are sensing pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we can start to experience how the mind tends to react or respond to pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral in a particular way, right? So we can start to see how vedana tends to push us, if you will, in a particular direction, which is where the third foundation of mindfulness comes in, which is mindfulness of mind. And before we explore this in more detail, we might first want to understand, well, what is mind exactly? What is it, right? What is the Buddha referring to when he talks about mind? And so often when we hear the word mind, we immediately think of the actual physical brain, right? That big lobed organ that sits in our skulls on top of our bodies. Isn't that what we think about, right? Some people believe the mind resides in the heart. You know. Others believe it operates all over the body, functioning through the brain and the nervous system. And most of us, again, tend to automatically think of the mind as me or mine, something that defines us. My mind defines me. Right? But in the Buddhist understanding, it's none of these things. In fact, you could search through the entire Pali canon looking for a single place in the body that the Buddha pointed to as the home of the mind or the home of the self. And you would not find this anywhere in the Pali Canon. Okay? Might also be interesting to know that modern science agrees with the Buddha. But 10 years ago, an article in Time magazine came out and basically reported this. After more than a century of looking for it, brain researchers have long since concluded that there is no conceivable place for a self to be located in the physical brain and that it simply does not exist. And when asked about this lack of self in the mind, the Buddhist master Ajahn Chah was said to have said, "You have to consider and contemplate this slowly. You can't just think about this, or your head will explode." Right? So in the Buddhist teachings, we often use the word mind to express the function of consciousness itself. But again, even though it's present in every thought, every perception, and feeling that we have, this consciousness does not have an independent existence. Doesn't have an independent existence, it's actually very much dependent. And in Buddhist terminology, you'll often hear the term dependent arising. Okay. And to break this down a little bit, consciousness only arises when one of the six senses or six organs or gates comes into contact with something in the world, which we refer to in Buddhist terms as an object that is felt or perceived. Okay? So in other words, consciousness is entirely dependent on this contact with something. Okay? You guys with me so far? Yeah. So this consciousness has different names according to which sense organ or gate has made contact with an object. Or since this body is home, a good way to remember that is like something has entered a real gate of some sort. Like somebody's opened the gate. Something's opened the gate and come in. So for instance, when the ear, or more specifically the eardrums, makes contact with a sound object, maybe the sound of a car passing by, the sound of a bird, right? That sound or vibration has entered the sense organ or gate of hearing, and sound consciousness arises. Sound consciousness arises. You might even notice this right now. If you have a sense of sound consciousness, sound or vibration making contact with the eardrums. Yeah? Even if it's my voice. So the same process applies to all the other physical sensations or senses, touch, taste, smell, sight. So when we hear a bird singing, we become conscious of that visitor of sound has entered the home of our body. And then we might perceive this vibration as car or bird, based entirely on our conditioning or our memory of this or something similar, right? Mm-hmm. It's based on memory, it's our conditioning. That sounds like X, Y, and Z. And then almost automatically, all this is very automatic, we form an opinion about it, right? Mm-hmm. We like it, we don't like it, we're neutral about it, we don't care, which, as you might imagine, is going to inform how we respond to it. That informs how we respond to it. And the idea is that we do this with absolutely everything, including our thoughts and memories, which are also considered objects of consciousness. Okay? And if you recall, the mind is often considered the sixth sense. So when consciousness makes contact with what is called an internal object, such as a thought or memories, we say that mind consciousness has arisen, okay? So a thought or memory enters the gate of the mind, we become conscious of this, and then we go through that whole process again, liking, not caring. And then we react to the thought or the thoughts or the memories. And while consciousness might seem like a constant thing, it's actually arising moment by moment as information is being received by all these senses. So again, it's very much dependent on it. And here you might think of a film, which is actually a series of snapshots, isn't it? Right? But when it all runs together, it appears completely seamless. But it's an illusion. It's an illusion. So I like the way Bhante Gunaratana describes the mind. It says, mind is a non-physical phenomena that perceives, thinks, recognizes, experiences, and reacts. It is clear and formless, which means that thoughts and other mind objects can arise in it. It is also described as luminous, which means able to shine light on things. In other words, knowing. Okay. So this knowing is sometimes referred to as citta, which in Pali means both mind and heart. And in our practice, what we're actually practicing is bodhicitta, which is awakened, bodhicitta, awakened mind-heart. We are practicing to become awake to this knowing. Not just knowing, awake to this knowing. Okay? And we are also being asked to become aware that this knowing is not us. It is empty of self. It simply knows. Okay. The reason this is important is that when we're not awake to the nature of our minds, our consciousness is naturally making contact with the world all the time. But we are unconsciously being pushed around by this entire process. And of course, this just leads us into more suffering, more dukkha. Right, which is often defined as dissatisfaction or not permanently satisfying. So for instance, when we are unaware, we might find ourselves constantly struggling with everything and everyone we come into contact with, basically reacting in a kind of never-ending push and pull, wanting more of what we perceive as pleasant, not wanting what we perceive as unpleasant, and being unaware or not caring about what we perceive as neutral. Okay. And so much of this push and pull is being controlled by what is called our conditioning. So this includes, as we know, everything we've ever been taught in our lives, right? Everything that's been plunked in there somehow by our parents, our families, our particular culture, our different religions, all the books that we've read and absorbed, all the television shows that we watched, all the movies, all the different news channels that we watch, and of course by all our experiences, where we were brought up in this world, all the people we've encountered, all the accidents and illnesses we've experienced, all our joys and sorrows, even our biological conditioning, how we're built, is considered our ancestral conditioning. We have that as well. Okay. So this conditioning is the water, if you will. It's what we've all been swimming in. And so like fish, we tend to not even question this conditioning. In fact, most of us, most of the time, are not even aware of the water, which is exactly what the teachings are trying to show us or reveal to us. The water, conditioning. When we're not aware of the water or this whole process, what happens is that we tend to take everything personally, which means we're going to relate with everything and everyone we come into contact with in terms of how it helps to maintain and support a sense of self. Every single thing, experience, person, all of it. the more unaware we are of this process, the more we're going to find ourselves constantly defending, defining, or propping up the sense of self, which, as the teachings show us, is not at all solid, but constantly shifting and changing along with everything else. My favorite Buddhist nun, as you all know, Pema Chodron, explains it to us this way. Once we have the fixed idea of this is me, then we see everything as a threat or a promise, or something we couldn't care less about. Whatever we encounter, we're attracted to it or averse to it or indifferent to it, depending on how much of a threat it is to our self-image. Think about that one. That one's a good one to chew on, right? And as I'm sure we all know, or we wouldn't be here doing this, this constant struggle is just completely exhausting, isn't it? It's exhausting. Maintaining and supporting, defining a self is completely exhausting. This is why becoming more aware of this whole process and the nature of our own minds is crucial, because we really want to see it so that we'll be better able to work with it and maybe break through it. Okay? And for me, this really is the beauty of the Buddhist teachings, because he shows us that not only do we have, all of us, we have the capability to see this, but we all possess the ability to train and literally transform our minds. And again, modern science has shown that the Buddha was right. Researchers have discovered that the physical brain is what we call plastic, which means that it can literally be molded and changed simply by us becoming aware of and training our thoughts, right? Which I just find fascinating. In the suttas, the Buddha often describes the untrained or unaware mind by using metaphor of different animals. So in one sutta, he describes this as a newly captured wild elephant that screams and tramples and pulls against the rope. Right? In another sutta, he refers to the untrained mind as wandering monkey mind, which you might imagine is when the mind is just swinging from limb to limb to limb, completely distracted, constantly moving, searching for that next thing, running away from that last thing, completely ignoring or being unaware of other things. You see that, wandering monkey mind. And with both these examples, we might imagine that when we are caught up in this kind of delusional struggle, which we so often are, what we are doing is clinging to what we think is going to bring us happiness, when what we really need to do is simply stop and let go. Both those examples, they're clinging and struggling. And of course, we all experience these mind states, probably very, very often, which is why the Buddha urges us, quote, meditate, bhikkhus, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. And so this is where the third foundation, mindfulness of mind, really comes into play. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha tells us this. In regard to the mind, one abides contemplating the mind, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. So I hope that you recognize that refrain that's used throughout. Okay? And there's actually a very common misunderstanding about meditation practice that tells us that in order to meditate well, we need to get rid of all our thoughts and achieve a kind of blank state of mind. Right? So, such a common misunderstanding, which is not only untrue, but really unhelpful, actually. If we're not training ourselves to become aware of how we perceive the world, and then how we react to everything that arrives with it, including ourselves, how are we going to expect ourselves to re-enter the world off the cushion and be with ourselves and others and the world as it is with any kind of sense of kindness or compassion or ease if we're just having a blank mind? And I think the poet Rumi captures this idea perfectly in just one brilliant line, where he asks, "If you are irritated by every rub, how will your mirror be polished?" God, I love it. If you are irritated by every rub, how will your mirror be polished? So this third Satipatthana practice is urging us to be mindful of mind and to stay embodied in these vulnerable, aging, aching human bodies as we're experiencing the world as it is, which is impersonal, impermanent, and imperfect. Anicca, anatta, and dukkha, the three characteristics. So this includes being aware of what we're thinking about and how, along with our state of mind and our habitual moods and conditioning, and questioning all of it, questioning all of it. One of the main reasons I so love the Buddhist practice is that it is asking us to really question everything and not just rely on outside authorities for the answers. Even the Buddha himself, he told us to question even him. Don't believe me. Don't believe the teachings, even. Go ahead and sit down and get quiet and see for yourself if it's true. You don't have to believe me. Go check it out. Go see. In fact, the great monk and scholar Tanisaro Bhikkhu tells us, the Buddha thought a lot. He set down guidelines for how to think. He didn't say not to think. He said to think in terms of appropriate attention, to ask ourselves questions as to what's skillful and what's not. Put things to the test. Evaluate them. There's a lot of thinking in following the path. So we're not trying to cut off our brains and just say, okay, well, I'll be like a vegetable and accept whether sun or rain comes my way. And in the Satipatthana Sutta that we're exploring, the Buddha gets very specific about how we can do this, explore and be mindful of mind. And so here, he asks us to be on the watch for 8 pairs of mental states and really get to know whether they're present or not. And maybe most importantly, to ascertain the difference between each of the pairs. Okay? So these mind states include those that are considered ordinary mind states and those ones that are considered higher states of mind. So the ordinary states of mind include what are called the three poisons, or what you might think of as the three categories of unwholesome mind states that are the root of all our pain and disappointment and suffering, which is clinging or greed, right? Clinging, aversion or hatred, and delusion, those three poisons. The fourth ordinary state of mind is an experience of the mind being distracted or contracted, which of course tends to lead us into the clinging and the aversion and the delusion. Okay? So these four ordinary states of mind, craving, aversion, delusion and distraction, are ones that we can experience both in our formal practice here while we're sitting and out in the world, of course. So we want to use our formal practice to really train ourselves to become aware of these mind states so that we can notice them in more and more moments of our daily lives. And the hope is that as we begin to see exactly where these unwholesome mind states are leading us, more and more we're just naturally going to want to abandon them, right? We will want to let go because we're going to start to feel the burn of them, if you will. The more we're aware of them, we're going to just really recognize, this is burning me, okay? And then we won't want to hold on anymore because we'll see it, feel it. At the same time, the more clearly we can see where these mind states lead, we're also going to more naturally want to cultivate the more wholesome mind states, because as we're training ourselves to pay closer attention, we'll truly see and experience how much more joy and ease those states bring to our lives. And we'll want to cultivate those naturally. There's actually a very simple line of truth from the Buddha that I often like to recall that helps me with this, especially when I'm reading the news these days. Whenever I find myself getting all caught up in sort of a sense of righteous anger and outrage or despair, you know, this line often comes to me as a reminder, so I hope it might help you to remember. Whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks upon, that will become the inclination of one's mind. Whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks upon, that will become the inclination of one's mind. So, really a warning here. To be clear, though, you know, it's not that the energy of anger is in any way wrong. It's actually a very natural human detector device, if you will, built-in detector device that can alert us when something is happening and that is harmful in some way, right? And we can absolutely harness its energy and direct it towards calling attention to that harm, but we do so from a place of caring for whatever it is that's being harmed, whether it's something within ourselves or something out in the world. It's just that when we keep grabbing onto the anger and really chewing on it, maybe even, or looking for it so that we can have that adrenaline rush of anger, that release of righteous anger maybe, what we're actually doing is practicing anger, right? And the danger here, of course, is when we do this too often, as the Buddha suggests, again, this would become the inclination of our mind, which is why it's so important to pay attention. Pay attention. Again, many of you have heard this. When I was living in New York City, a Buddhist activist I met gave me some great advice on this, which was, don't go to a peace rally angry.
Right.
So to make it even more clear or simple, with this third satipatthana, what we're being asked to do here is intimately track our various mind states and discover which ones lead to suffering and which ones are going to lead us to happiness. It can be that simple. In fact, the Buddha told us, I teach only two things. Volumes and volumes of the Pali Canon, right? And really, he says, I teach only two things, O disciples, the nature of suffering and the cessation of suffering. Mm-hmm. That's it. The Buddha also points to the teachings in another sutta called the Two Kinds of Thoughts, where he's explaining to his students how he overcame the unwholesome thoughts that would arise in his mind before he became enlightened. He said this, before he became enlightened. He said, it occurred to me, suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes. On one side, I set thoughts of sensual desire, ill will, and cruelty. On the other side, I set thoughts of renunciation, loving friendliness, and compassion. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire would arise in me. When I considered that this thought leads to my own affliction and the affliction of others, it subsided in me. When I considered that this thought obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana, it subsided in me. Thus, I abandoned it, did away with it, removed it. And he repeats this with all of them, all the unwholesome thoughts. And so the idea is that when we can clearly see where our thoughts of craving, aversion, and delusion are leading us, we can abandon them. We can train ourselves to abandon them. And when we do this, we then get to examine the other four states of mind, which are the higher states of mind. And these are ones we generally experience through our more dedicated practice here on the cushion. And they include the experience of expansion, development, or bhavana, that's where the bhavana comes from, development, freedom, transcendence, and concentration, the higher mind states. And here we're asked to notice how the mind experiences freedom from the states of clinging, aversion, and delusion, and how exquisite that feels, how freeing it feels to let go of the struggle and to rest in awareness itself, residing with impermanence, with the arising and passing of all things, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desire and discontent in regard to the world. So in the middle length discourses, there's a story about Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and also his main attendant for many years. And Ananda was recounting to a group of monks these wonderful qualities of the Buddha, or the Tathagata, which means one who has gone thus. And Tathagata is the enlightened one. He calls himself that sometimes, the Tathagata. So the Buddha, who was listening to all of this, said in reply, "That being so, Ananda, remember this too is a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. For the Tathagata, feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, are present, and disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, are present, and disappear. Remember this too, Ananda, as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata." And here you might want to remember that the Buddha had let go of self. So he wasn't saying, I'm the best, I'm the Tathagata. He was saying, this is what happens, this is what we can all achieve when we can let go. In a very similar way, one of my teachers, Bhikkhu Anayo, who is one of the foremost scholars on the Satipatthana Sutta, has famously summed up the entire practice, as we all know, in four words. You all could probably recite this now. And this is, keep calmly knowing change. Keep calmly knowing change. He just summed up what the Buddha said right there, right? And I love that phrase for so many reasons, mostly because not only is it telling us how we're being asked to practice, but it's also a perfect description of enlightenment itself, when we can do as the Buddha described. Keep calmly knowing change, when we can do that. Mm-hmm. And the way we practice this, of course, is through our formal training, by using our meditation practice to very closely investigate all eight of these mind states, continually, calmly, being curious about what's happening, okay? And so generally, we start with the first four by noticing, for instance, is the mind experiencing clinging or attachment right now or not? Very simple questions you can ask yourself, inquire, get to know. Is the mind experiencing aversion or hatred right now or not? Is the mind experiencing a sense of delusion right now or not? Wait, do you see the pairing or not? The pairing is that or not. Is the mind contracted or distracted or not? So really use that in your practice to ask yourself. And what is important to remember here is that it's less about investigating the particular thoughts that are arising, but the underlying mood or tone of the mind, okay? The water that the thoughts are swimming in, if you will, right? So it could be swimming in clinging or aversion or delusion. Don't get caught up in the thoughts. So instead of getting out the microscope and really dissecting our thoughts, trying to figure them out or fix them, you know, like we might do in a therapist's office, we are being asked to take a much broader view and consider, okay, is the mind feeling frustrated or angry, or does it feel calm and peaceful? Is the mind feeling anxious or tense, or is it relaxed and spacious? Is it feeling confused or numb, or does it feel clear? In fact, very often our actual thoughts around an experience or a situation might be unconscious under the surface, but we can usually sense a particular mood that's being created by these thoughts or informing these thoughts, right? Sometimes we don't even know what's going on. We just have that mood in the mind. Mm-hmm. There's aversion, or there's, you know, maybe there's calm. And often if we stay with it, it might even bring the actual thoughts up out of the dark, right? Mm-hmm. If we can stay with it. One of the reasons it's vitally important that we investigate the underlying mood or water of the mind is that, again, whatever we're experiencing is creating an atmosphere in the mind that is influencing how we perceive things, influencing it. It's what the mind is soaking up, if you will, just like water. Or maybe it's coloring it like a dye. And this is going to have the effect of reinforcing or bolstering both our conscious and our unconscious beliefs, and then solidifying them, making them feel real. So just as a simple example of this, maybe we're feeling sick in some way or experiencing some illness or pain in the body. Maybe it's just a pain in the knees or the neck or the hips or something, right? Anybody doing that now? Yeah? So if there's a mind state or mood of aversion, a sense of I don't want, or even strong hatred towards an experience, or even ourselves, it's actually going to make our experience of unpleasant even worse just by how we're perceiving it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Makes it so much worse. We're going to tighten up around it, both mentally and physically, and of course we're just going to suffer that much more. And again, the point is that we tend to do this with everything. We layer our experience with all of our conditioning, our opinions, our likes and dislikes, all our ancient beliefs, which is exactly what the Satipatthana is trying to crack into and release. To quote Pema again, as we move in the direction of seeing more space around our fixed ideas, around our limited sense of self, around our notions of right and wrong, around the labels we are so invested in, the crack of our conventional way of experiencing life will get wider and wider. At that point, it may start to dawn on us that if we want to change the movie of our life, we will have to change our mind. I think I will leave you there with that one, mindfulness of mind. So let's just settle to end. And I'll just give you, in the last 5 minutes, just a brief meditation here on mindfulness of mind. So just let's breathe in deeply, filling the body. And then a slow exhale. Couple of rounds of these just to relax the mind and body and settle here. And kind of open up to the mind, allowing the breath to help the mind to become more clear and settled. I notice your hands, remembering that. And here we want to let go. Open the hands in a gesture of letting go. And as you're ready, I'm just going to invite you to question, experience. Is the mind experiencing any clinging or attachment right now, wanting? Is there wanting in the mind or not? Even notice thoughts of I want, I wish it were, I wish, I want, or it should be. And then you might let go of the individual thoughts and just notice the water, the mood of the mind. You might also notice if it's experiencing not wanting, aversion, or not. Maybe delusion or contraction, distraction, or not. In the next couple of minutes, just explore, be mindful of mind. And if you see unwholesome kind of thoughts or moods, what would it be like to just drop them, abandon them, and nurture some more wholesome qualities of mind? Bhikkhus, in regard to the mind, one abides contemplating the mind, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Free from desires and discontent in regard to the world.